Good Saturday morning to you, and thank you so much for joining us for our inaugural episode of The Crow's Nest. We are here talking with Dr. Kevin Crow from University of Science and Arts of Oklahoma. I'm Kelly Lewis. Thomas Ware III is with me, and Dr. Kevin Crow is here. Welcome, gentlemen.
Oh, well, thank you.
How's everything going?
One of the things that we want to achieve with this show is to kind of talk about politics from opposite ends, but have a rational discourse to where we can kind of come to the middle and agree to see where we can kind of look for some solutions. I think in Oklahoma, that's extremely important. We don't have a lot of that. And so one of the things I did want to talk to you about today, Dr. Crow, and to kind of kick this off is let's talk about the upcoming midterm elections here in Oklahoma and kind of get your thought on the nature of the midterms and are they really kind of necessary?
From the state perspective, or from
from the state.
Well, yeah, I mean there are we have several. First of all, even though it's the midterm elections, it's still our primary election for governor.
So yes,
that'll bring a lot of people out, and I think it'll be fairly close.
Now, that's what I'm saying is, I mean, just like with the schedule of it, you know, I mean, do you think that all of the issues, like the major issues, should be in like presidential election years? Well, or you know what I mean? Because
I'll tell you a bigger problem than that. I mean, that's okay if it's every 2 years. I mean, but the bigger problem is what we do every year. Every year we have, and I checked the 2018 schedule, there's 6 election days in 2018. That's the problem. Because what happens is, I mean, people are pretty good about the general election showing up, the November election. People are actually fairly good about primary elections, you know, in June. But then people forget about the other 4 election days. And you can see how few people turn out on those. I mean, nobody thinks about February showing up for a vote. And so what'll happen is a lot of times, you know, special interests will put maybe a vote on a tax that day. Because they're the only ones that'll know about it, and everybody else will forget. And so you'll see a lot of things get passed on those February dates, or on those March dates, or on those April dates that no one thinks about. So I think it would probably be better to have no more than, at most, 3 election days a year. You know, keep the November ones. That's the general one. You could do a primary one, and then you could have one for a runoff. But then all the days that you vote on taxes or school boards, that's the other one. Nobody votes for school boards. All of those should be, the school board elections should probably be the same day either as the primary, in case you have a runoff, or the runoff, and then they could do their runoff in the general, something like that. I think it would be best if we had no more than 3 days for elections a year.
And that actually brings up something really interesting is that bond issues. We had actually talked about that on the weekly show, and a lot of things that kind of get slipped past us are in these minor elections.
That's right. By design.
Of course. Of course. Now, what was the other thing we were talking about, Thomas? 25th Amendment.
Yes.
I wanted to get your opinion on that. That's in the news, of course. The whole Trump administration, it's so completely different than the political landscape has ever seen. And so now all of a sudden, if you would tell us what the 25th Amendment is.
Well, the 25th Amendment was put in case, if the president became mentally impaired. And the last time that I had heard this considered was actually during the Reagan administration. After there was no need for it, okay? But during that, it was after the assassination attempt, a little bit after that. They didn't know about his recovery, if this affected him or whatever. And there were a few of his aides, and I forgot which ones, if it was Donald Reagan or which ones, but there were a few of them they had thought about. And they watched him in the meetings, and it turned out, not a problem. So that was probably the last time somebody's considered. Again, it would have to be, the initiative has to come with the cabinet, the vice president, so it has to come from within, the initiative does. And that's the last time I've heard somebody think about it, would have been then, from within.
Well, it's kind of interesting because we had talked a little bit of kind of conspiracy theory esque of you know, the Koch brothers kind of being behind Pence a little more than what they are with Trump. And would that be motivation for Mike Pence to invoke that 25th Amendment?
I don't think Pence would, because I think Pence would think it would probably delegitimize him. I don't think he would come in that way as much. I mean, you have to think politically, and again, I'm not a Pence expert.
Yeah.
But my thinking is with Pence, he's not as, I know he has gray hair, but that's premature gray. He's not that old. So from Pence's idea, you know, you think he would be the nominee in 6 years, sorry, we're almost due there. Within 6 years, I would think he would probably wait on that more.
And then another thought that I had was, what if the president was mentally ill when he was elected?
I mean, well, and how do you even, I mean, how would you even quantify that? I mean, Trump wouldn't go like, well, willingly.
What level of mental illness would they have to be?
First of all, you have to look. Anyone who would run for president nowadays would be mentally ill. Who would want the job now? But that's why the provisions are there for the inner circle. I mean, more for the cabinet and all that, because they would be the people who could judge best. And it is a high threshold. It's a pretty high threshold. And stuff, but
well, and really, I mean, even though I highly disagree with almost everything Trump does, I don't really think that they could qualify that. I mean, you know, because it's like I said, I mean, there would have to be a high threshold. And okay, so let me ask you about this anonymous op-ed that's going around, and it just all seems so weird to me.
These have always, if you look at previous administrations, a lot of them, there's always been people inner circle that'll be sabotaged. That's not abnormal. You'll remember when Reagan was in, all the kiss and tell books. I mean, there was several people who would write stuff. And I use him because he was a fairly popular president at the time, but even he had a lot of those. And again, it's bipartisan. I mean, you can look at all the people, you know, when Clinton was in. Think about Dick Morris.
Yes.
I mean, that was his biggest confidant who turned on him. So again, this is something that you see in general. I'm trying to think of the last president who didn't have that trouble. You know, most of them will have somebody who will turn on them and stuff.
Maybe Obama. I mean, did Obama have anybody that really turned? I mean, he didn't really have. I mean,
with that, you almost wonder how much tension there is between Obama and Hillary, though. I mean, there's a little bit more. I think both of those were a little more Machiavellian about how they handled stuff instead of being up front. But there's some animosity there. I mean, people always hook those two together. But I don't think I'd hook those two together.
I wouldn't. I mean, even as a Democrat, yeah. I mean, yeah, I see the
they
animosity.
They're very different. They're very different.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think, you know, as the Democrats go, we don't really have anybody who's like exciting. You know, even just as an Oklahoma Democrat, my bar is set really low for Democrats and stuff. And not really, but you know, I mean, I would vote for Republican if I felt like they represented my interests better. But you know, just as far as Democrats go, who are we going to put forth? Joe Biden?
Biden. Again, I'm not a Democrat, so but having said that, Biden is somebody who could win.
Yeah,
Biden has he has a good rapport with just the average person.
He's legit too.
That's one thing that he has going for him. And people can say, well, he's goofy. A lot of them are goofy, but he's likable.
Yeah. He's got legitimate experience for it, and you know, a gold star. He's a gold star parent. Right.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's highly qualified. So, but I mean, does qualifications even mean anything in this day and age now?
I feel like we're looking now more at what celebrity is going to be the best one to beat Donald Trump. Like, people are bringing up Oprah.
Ooh.
And you know what I mean? Like, people that have no experience in politics.
Exactly.
And that's kind of, I guess, where we are now, because people were so fed up with the career politicians and the corruption or whatever, and it went completely the other direction with Donald Trump as somebody who has no history.
Well,
no,
and you
can history.
Also have something that neither party foresees. You can have a sleeper candidate real easy. I mean, you could have somebody, and again, I'm not endorsing this person. I'm just saying the type that could take off within the Democratic Party. You could have somebody like an Evan Bayh, which nobody's seen because right now they see the battle in the Democratic Party is between, I guess, more left or then more ones in finance. Well, he's not either one to a degree. Does that make sense? And so who might, and again, Evan Bayh being from Indiana, that kind of cuts into
Pence.
Areas where Trump and Pence are strong in. So that's somebody that the Democrats haven't even thrown out, and you could always have that to come out. I mean, again, go back to 76. Carter came out of nowhere.
Obama came out of nowhere.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, and actually, I guess if you kind of look back at it, Bill Clinton kind of came out of nowhere, too. Even though he was the Arkansas governor, he was still kind of a long shot in the primary, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean
you,
he
you
had to
go back
Arsenio
to those
Hall.
And you can look at all the different people, who ran at that time and this stuff. And then you can always have these ones who are presumed this is going to be the person, and then, and that happens both ways. You can look at, like, again, with
Hillary.
Well, I was thinking the last Bush. Yeah. I mean, here he goes, and he spends, you know, $1 million getting ready for those first primaries, and he's gone. Or you could have, like, Gary Hart. I mean, you can always have one that this is it, and then something happens, boom, and that's it. And you never know.
Yep.
And again, if you think about this, with Gary Hart, if his scandal would have been 4 years later, he still would have been the nominee. I mean, you know, there's all a matter of timing and everything, too.
That's true. And so, I mean, so let's talk about political scandal, especially in this landscape. I mean, things have to go so far now for us to be scandalized. Because, I mean, so how do we, where do we bring that into the conversation of kind of trying to bring that back down to where we have like a moral compass or do we even need to look to our government for that?
It's almost
kind
like
of,
we're desensitized to the scandal, like something isn't as big of a deal as what it used to be. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, well, you said grab him by, you know, and then it's just kind of blown off.
Well, and everything below that is just, well, at least he didn't say that, or,
that's
you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's another problem, too, and I always call, again, I'm an ancient historian, I always call this the Alcibiades effect, and I'll explain who this is. In ancient Athens, there was a politician by the name of Alcibiades, and he was very effective, but he was scandalous. He was horribly scandalous. Well, the problem is after he fell from power, people would try to be like him because they saw how successful he was in politics, but they mistook his scandalous personality with what made him successful. And so you have these people that keep digging lower and lower thinking that's what made him successful. And you could have the same thing. You could have some presidents that could be very successful and people say, well, look at what they say. Look at how outrageous they are. But that may have not been why they were successful. But then people mistake, you know, what made them successful, and so they imitate the wrong policy, the wrong behavior,
and that resonates with voters. Though it obviously resonates with voters because voters, no matter how many, if there's only 200 or if there's 2,000, those voters are going to make the choice. So that message, and I think that's where I have an issue with this political landscape now, is it's really becoming more divisive. And for brown people, that's really scary.
Yeah.
You know, and so where do we go to kind of get back toward the middle? You know, where do we start that conversation at? You
well,
know?
We can look at things that everybody agrees on. And one thing is transparency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's something that I think. I'll give an example how they're not as far apart as people think. Let's take the extremes and show you actually their concerns the same. So you see this movement. I'm going to do both of these in just a second. On the one hand, with Republicans, there'll be a move towards a kind of more, some, there's a rabid libertarian strain. You know, get government out, all of this. And that's, and again, not that that's the at the core, but you'll see that. On the Democrat side now, you have this kind of some who openly will say socialism. And they seem like, oh, look, we're going in two opposite directions. That's one way to look at it. But if you look at the concern that drives people towards those extremes, the concern is fairly similar. I'll give you an example. With the libertarian Republicans, their fear is that they're losing their liberty. So they see government interference too much. They're afraid whether it's whether it's the Patriot Act, whatever. I mean, they fear this. And they can see life is control over their life is slipping, especially, again, government interference. On the other hand, while it looks like these, especially younger Democrats who are moving towards socialism, it looks like that's the opposite direction, their concern's the same. What their fear is exactly the same, loss of control over their own life. Now, for them, what they see, what's oppressing them is, they come out with huge college debts or whatever. And so they see that they have no control over the direction of their life. So for both of them, while they manifest themselves in opposite policies, the concern is the same. They're losing control over their own life. And so the concern's the same.
But how do you harness that? How do you turn that to where, I mean, how do you convince people to vote what's good for them? Because one of the things that I see, and it's really striking to me, is how people vote against their own best interests.
True. Well, one thing I think is despair. Despair is what they have in common. I think that's what both the Democrats and Republicans both have. I'm talking about the voters. I'm not talking about the politicians. Despair. And I think we have to show people that they can make a difference. But the problem is, if you look at the whole political system, it's clear money rules. And that's both sides. And I'll use two examples, two great examples. We always think, you'd think that even fame would be good on your side, but people prefer money. Let me give you a Republican example, then I'll use a Democrat example. Republican example. Take Rush Limbaugh for a second. Imagine being a Republican for a second. Let's say you're a Republican running in a primary or whatever. Okay. Can you imagine having anything better than having Rush Limbaugh come out for you?
Oh, no.
Okay, you would think, oh, this will be great. Okay, Rush Limbaugh always talks about how he rarely endorses, which is actually true, okay?
Yeah, that is true.
Okay, well, the thing is this. He had a senator a few years ago who he would endorse and pushed for. And he said, he wasn't upset, but he said, the senator really, he would run into him, but he never really gave him the time of day, even though he endorsed. He said a few years later, he rarely contributed. But he said a few years later, he actually contributed just a little, just like $1,000, because he thought the guy, and he said he doesn't contribute much. He said immediately after that, when he would run into the guy would come right up to him. Well, what do you think? What do you think for such a little amount? That shows you it's an auction. I mean, here the guy didn't pay him any attention when he would endorse him, and you'd think that'd be the biggest thing. But when he got a little money, then he paid attention. Okay, that's one side.
Yeah, and I can see that.
And on the other side, you see on the Democrats, you'll see these huge dinners, these huge, thousands and thousands of dollar plate. And that's who makes the decisions. Because as we've said before, you look at either one, whether it's a Republican that gets in or whether it's a Democrat that gets in, Goldman Sachs going to have a seat at the table.
For sure.
I mean, we can look at both parties. I mean, you look at the advisors, and they come out of Goldman Sachs, and they go into Goldman Sachs. And that doesn't matter whether we're talking about Clinton, Obama, Bush. It really doesn't matter. And so I think this is something that all voters have in common, the despair, the fact that their voice doesn't matter. And until that is tackled, until we have transparency, until we show that it's not just an auction, we're going to have problems. And I think that's what plays into the extremes.
And
so what a Republican or a Democrat, either one, could do is to push for transparency and things of that nature. And they should both have that in common. An honest one on either side should have that in common.
And how do you start to demand that from your elected officials? Is that transparency when transparency doesn't? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, and
it's just a culture of non-transparency.
Exactly. And transparency is a slippery slope.
You have to expose them. And it's real simple to do this. Anybody can do this if you put these two together. You can now find who the top contributors are. I mean, that's easy. Any candidate, you can do this. I ran, you can look mine up. I mean, anybody, you can do this. You can find any candidate, you can find who their top contributors are. Find that list. if you look, it's much, this is easier at the state level, but start at the state level. People forget, I mean, that actually impacts us as much as the national level does. People forget that. They always focus on the national. But really, in your day-to-day life, the state stuff impacts you just as much, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, except for national defense. I mean, you know, right. That's basically there. Well, what you can do is you can find out any candidate's contributors, their main contributors. Take that and take any state legislator, representative or senator. They'll only get so many bills that they can propose that are going to be heard. Look at their top five bills that they're going to get heard. Take that list of bills and then take their list of their top five or six donors and see if there's a correlation. And if there's a correlation, that just needs to be made public. Now, sometimes some people may not have a problem with it. Let's say, again, I'm not saying this is good or bad, but let's say somebody's big contributor is the NRA, okay? Uh-huh. And then they have NRA bills. For some people, they may not be bothered by that. But that's not what most of them are. Most of them are special interest. So, for example, there'll be this corporation, and this bill directly relates to that corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And people always think the big ones, they'll think stuff like, oil industry or wind industry, and they do it. But the fact is, it's small industries do this. It's any type of industry does this. It's not just the big ones that we just think of. And I think something that would be useful is for that just to be made public. Here's their top five. Here's the top five bills they proposed. And if people could see that, because the government's not going to do it, a politician, this is something that people are just going to have to start doing. Publish. This should start with the media.
It really should. And, in the spirit of that, you can go to oklegislature.gov and you can find all of the bills that are coming up. You can find all of the bills that are proposed, and you can find all of this information that we're talking about online because it's all public record.
That's right. That's right.
And so now we were talking about something else earlier, which is the $10 million shift from FEMA to ICE and to Homeland Security. Your thoughts, sir?
I mean, $10 million at the national level is not
it's
huge.
It's a drop in the bucket.
But in
disaster relief, though.
It's in disaster relief. And now as soon as we need it, the country needs it. It's like, now we've got this giant category for hurricane barreling towards the coast,
Remember, there's always a delay for government. So when that was shifted, the fear might have been more for ICE. I mean, there might have been a fear of whatever. I mean, like I said, if we go back a little while, I know there was fear of terrorists working with drug cartels, whatever. But there's always a delay. And so the fact is, that may have been the problem 3 years ago. Or a year or two ago. But now, like you said, now what happens is the real crisis now turns out to be the hurricane. So there's always that matter of foresight, and everything too. So, yeah.
Well, and so about that, I mean, and I'm just enough of a conspiracy theorist to where that $10 million, I'm thinking, they're trying to raise that money for the border wall and ICE and these detention centers. And I know... I know that that's all going on, but still and as a grant writer and as someone who's had to deal with federal funds, I know how easily they can be shifted and how there's a certain amount of your budget that you do not have to account for that shift. And that amount, that $10 million was just enough to where he didn't have to account for that or get any kind of prior approval for it. And I know that Trump's not the only one. I know it happens in every government agency, in every administration. But I mean, I'm having issues wrapping my head around that and just this whole child separation issue and border wall and just, I mean, is that really a rational, efficient use of our resources?
It's priorities. I think it's kind of what you're looking at is what is the priority? Because that was a lot of Trump's platform was immigration and, That was kind of a lot of what carried him through was the people that felt the same about immigration. And it kind of just shows to me where his priorities kind of lie at.
And well, and also you have to remember, immigration is actually bipartisan more than people think, because again, you know, if you have costs there, that cuts into the, how much you can spend on citizens. I mean, you know, there is this. You know, traditionally, if you think about this, you know, they're not at the leadership, but at the basic level, you know, unions once upon a time believed in lower immigration because it does undercut American workers. So it's kind of, and it works the other way too when we talk about open immigration. That's just not Democrats that support open immigration.
Oh, no.
You know, corporate Republicans like that cheap labor.
Yes.
You know, they like it. So that issue, it's always, you know, immigration is always portrayed as a Democrat versus Republican, and I don't think it is. I mean, I think it cuts straight across political parties. I think you see this in a lot of stuff, things that will, you know, we talked about, for example, you remember the years ago when there was the Patriot Act. If you look at who voted for it and the ones that voted against it, wasn't that many. The biggest supporters and the biggest critics of the Patriot Act were both Republicans. I mean, it cut straight across. But that's the same with immigration as well.
Well, and I'm a Democrat, and I'm not for open borders. I'm absolutely not for open borders. So, you know, it's just, and I'm a gun owner. So, yeah. I mean, I'm not so completely that far to the left to where, but I just want... I want people to kind of educate themselves about this stuff and really kind of think about it and just not accept things at face value of, oh, that's what they say is going on, then that must be it, you know. And so how do we start to move toward that, to where we can kind of encourage others to kind of just do what we're doing, just kind of talk about it and say, hey, you know what, we know that we're on opposite sides of the spectrum, but we can still talk about it.
Well, one thing is we can't let people get away with issues that they think divide. Again, I mentioned immigration, yeah, it's divided, but it's not part along party affiliation. But I'll give you other things that people think of too. Take, for example, this will be very controversial as a Republican, me mention this, but I will. Take, for example, Social Security. You know, I don't think most Republican voters are anti-Social Security.
Right. I mean, I don't either.
They're really not. And again, you know, in theory, we can always say, oh, look at the dangers, look at the problems Social Security caused or whatever. But the problem is, after 50 years, our entire economy, our entire health system, everything is tied in with that. And you just can't cut it. You know, if you go back 50 years, we could say, was this a good policy or bad initially? That's a different story, but that's beside the point. That's, I'm sorry, 70 years ago.
And again,
I mean, there were reasons for it to come in 7 years ago, but now you can't just readjust things that quickly. But by the same token, I'll show you how this gets even in with tax policy. You know, I've always said that the one tax... The one deduction that we should always have. See, I always thought it'd be better to get rid of all the deductions. Because if you look at deductions, it only helps a few, and then lower the rates. But the one deduction that's key is for children. And people will say, well, you know, you'll hear Bill Maher or somebody like that say, well, I didn't have any children. I mean, why should I have to pay for your children? My answer is this: Social Security. Here's why. We don't pay into our own Social Security.
Right.
You and I pay for 80-year-old people's right. Social Security. And so the people that will pay for our Social Security, these 20-year-olds. So the thing is this, if we're going to have Social Security, then yes, I need to let people with children have tax breaks. That's a public good. And that's another thing, too. We always ought to ask on any policy, is this just a special interest or is this for the common good? And that's why, like I said, so when we're dealing with tax deductions for children, this is always certainly for the common good.
And, you know, and that's another issue where I'm more moderate, is that I want my taxes to go to kids. I don't have children, but I want these kids to have a good education. I want them to be able to, you know, go farther and not have to take on this debt. I want them to be able to have that education. So when they are taking care of me and in my later years, whatever, with Social Security, I just want them to be educated enough to be able to help me get to, you know, do the things I need to do in my older life.
And there's also the notion, this, even though you said you didn't have children, I'm sure you have nephews. I'm sure you have nieces. And even if you didn't, you have a sense of community.
Sure. In other,
like you said, you're not just saying, well, you know, this is just the country of Kelly Lewis. I mean, it is you are part of a society. And so the thing is, you know, being a society means the old. It means our past, but it also means our future and the well-being. And this is a danger in politics, is where everybody has started to pull out to be on their own. That's dangerous. That's dangerous. Very dangerous.
And you know, and here's the other thing too. I like to gripe. So I willingly pay my taxes. Yeah. And I go and I gripe to my elected officials about the schools and about the different issues and things like that. And that's really, you know, that's one of the reasons why I just completely, I'm okay with paying taxes, because and it was just like you said, the money matters. And, you know, even just as a taxpayer, just calling and getting involved and just that, I'm a taxpayer.
But you also want transparency to know where it's going.
You
don't want it for special interest. That's the problem. Yeah.
But that, you know, and just especially with this education and the shortage in teacher pay and all this kind of stuff, I mean, we pay in, especially as a single woman with no children, I pay in a lot of taxes, a lot. So I feel like I should be able to call these people and say, what are you doing with this money that I'm giving you?
That's right.
So, I mean, and I think that's one of the things that we really need to encourage people to do, is just to call their elected representatives, even if they're not part of your party.
That's right. Exactly. But and also, like I said, keep up with where the money goes. I mean, you know, people always think that, you know, that the Democrats are the ones that tax and spend. But remember, there is a lot of corporate welfare out there, too.
Oh, man.
And people forget that.
A lot.
And so people should watch where the money goes. And you can even do that at a local level. If you look, even at, you'll see towns, for example, maybe raise a tax. And they'll say, well, this is for the public good. And they'll say, we want to have, for example, maybe a community center or something like that. Okay, that's great. But a lot of times it'll be a community center that will still have a fee. Well, if that's it, what you're essentially doing is taxing poor people to subsidize people who have the money to pay a fee in the first place.
I see that.
Do you see what I'm saying? So you have to watch, is this really for everybody? Or, you know, is everybody really going to get to enjoy this? Or is it just a small group that's going to get to enjoy this?
And that actually is, that's something that we see in a lot of different arenas.
Yes.
Again, what do we as just citizens do? How do we go about kind of catching that, just to stay informed, I guess?
Yeah, there are always public forums. So if it's the city, you can always go to a city council meeting. You know, just keep up with the news and read anything specifically. Like when a tax measure comes out, go and find what it's actually saying, not just what's printed. You can actually find what it says. And a lot of times when you vote on a measure, what it actually says is not just the part that you're looking at on the ballot. You know, in Arkansas, they say, well, we can't print that whole ballot. You know, in Arkansas, when I was a resident of Arkansas, sometimes I had to vote absentee, and they would send me a ballot. And I would have ballots, an absentee ballot, that was the size of a poster board. So they would put it there. And when you went to vote, and they said, well, that's expensive. But when you go vote that day, they would have the entire measure written out. And it may be a poster board, but it was there for you to read. Now, I don't know why in the state of Oklahoma they think we're too dumb to read the whole thing. And I find that, you know, but I want to read it.
It's insulting.
That's right. And you've seen when you have a law that we're voting on, a lot of times, or a measure, it's worded the opposite of what it actually does.
Yes. And that drives me absolutely insane. And that's something that I feel like we don't talk about, not in high school, not in even a lot of the college courses, is that, you know, kind of up is down, black is white. You have to kind of read between the lines and understand the nuances of what's actually being said.
This is all getting back to the transparency part.
That's it.
I mean,
You know, what you'll see is a lot of times when we think that they'll vote this way and that way, I think when people actually see what they're actually what's actually being spent, where it goes, I don't think there's as much difference as people think. I think what happens is, I think Republicans go in with certain ideological blinders and Democrats go in with certain ideological blinders, and whoever's writing the legislation on how it's going to how that bill's going to be worded, they'll use certain words that will appeal to one group or the other. But if they actually read what it says, it may not be doing what, you know, the law may not be doing what they're told. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, and so but that's just like the same thing. It's just like, I mean, how are you going to tell people who, I say lazy.
Yeah.
I do. I say lazy. If you're not going to take that initiative to kind of educate yourself about the issues or your candidates or even just vote, you know, even just getting out to vote. I mean, and I understand people are busy and whatever, whatever. But to me, it's just as simple as taking care of yourself and your family.
And what's weird is the when people vote, the issues that they don't pay attention to are a lot of times more important than the ones that they pay attention to. You know, a national election, you know, you're one of 320 million citizens, so your vote may not matter that much. But if it's in a city or if it's a county measure, your vote really does count, especially if it's on one of those off days. You know, you'll have big measures that'll go through with 600 votes. Now, that really does matter. And again, in defense of a lot of people, they're so, you know, they work so much, they're so tired, you know, and they just get home and they got the kids. It is wearing. But by the same token, the government should not make it difficult to find these things. That's why I said, at the very least, when we go and vote, there should be the law written right there on a table so you can read it before you go vote. You know, I mean, that takes a little effort, but still, that makes it easier than what we have now.
Now, okay, so that actually brings up a really interesting point about the medical marijuana, Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority and their rules and how they kind of, it was so vague when it was on the ballot. It's just like they had to go back. If they would have done it the way that you suggested and had it just written out.
Yes.
You know, I think it would have made a difference, but again, there's so many people who are just, I'm not going to read that. I'm not going to understand that. And I think a lot of it, people just kind of maybe underestimate themselves. Like, I don't want to read this, or if I don't understand this, I don't want to look stupid if I got to ask what this word, you know what I mean? I just don't know. What is it?
Well,
I mean,
the level of education in Oklahoma isn't exactly the highest. And so there probably are a lot of people that don't comprehend legalese, as some people call it.
But again, that's a problem with the legislature, because people can write bills that are understandable. Mm. I mean, we do this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, most newspapers are written, I think, at, what, sixth grade or eighth grade level. You could do that with laws. I mean, you can write it at a... This is something that always gets me. And, you know, I think I've mentioned this before in this state, and this was not true in Arkansas, and I can't remember if it was true in Kentucky or not. But for example, in Arkansas, if you wanted to run for state legislature and you were a teacher, you could do that. Okay, you could do it. Okay, you wouldn't necessarily lose your job. I mean, you have to kind of make it work. So you had to figure out how you were going to do that. In Oklahoma, that's illegal. I mean, you got to give up your job. And people say, well, that's because there's a conflict of interest. Okay, I'll leave that to people, okay? Is there or is there not? But here's the point. If that's true, if there's a conflict of interest, then why is it... And by the way, I know some good lawyers or legislators. I want to stress this. I know one in particular that's very good. But having said that, then why is it that most legislators are lawyers? Because if you're looking for a real conflict of interest, if these laws are written by lawyers, they'll write them complicated on purpose.
And that's what I was just going to get to, and that was the whole point of it, and I'm glad you said it, is they're doing it on purpose.
On purpose.
On purpose to make sure that we, and some of it is so convoluted. I mean, even educated people like the ones at this table can't even understand
it. Well, and
it.
The same thing is when we talked about money, influence, and politics, you can look at this. This is why tax law is difficult because, you know, you'll have money sent by, you know, accounting firm. I mean, you know, there's always a special interest. It's complicated by design. And I'll say this, and I had some of my Republican friends who would talk about the marijuana legislation. It was a big mess up and all that. And they said, well, that's because those potheads wrote it when they were high and all that. But, you know, I actually don't think that's it. I think it was by design. I think the people that wrote it are people that had a moneyed interest. I think that there's probably people in the marijuana industry, and they wanted to make sure that they had their foot in the door. They were going to make money. And I think there's reasons that it was written badly, because you'll notice how quickly they could come in and you know, in other words, there was going to be a specific interest who was going to make money from it. Well, and so that's why it was written badly.
But the state is going to be one of those ones that's going to make the money from it. And they're making, I mean, they're turning, it's almost like they're allowing the municipalities to come in and make the rules. It's just, I think it was so vague in the beginning because they didn't think it would pass. That's why. Maybe. I feel like it
but,
was
But like I said,
so
I think
vague.
There's also a way for somebody to take advantage of how it was worked.
But there always is. I mean, that's the unintended consequences of these bills is somebody's going to get paid.
Yeah.
Somebody somewhere. And that's why we always say follow the
money. I wouldn't say unintended.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
For real. I mean, some of this stuff is highly intended, completely intentional. But, you know, I mean, but it's like I said, I think that 57% that voted for 788, I think that was underestimated. I really don't think that a lot of the citizens in Oklahoma did. I don't think that they thought it was going to pass. I think that everybody expected it to be close.
Yeah.
But I think in the end, a lot of people thought it was going to fail. And, you know, as far as like, just like some of it is propaganda out there. Now, some of the concerns are legit, and I get that, but some of it is just like carryover propaganda from, like, I don't know, just like this stuff's not even true. And it's being disseminated by the news media, by the Oklahoma news media.
Even when the vote takes place, there are political considerations. See, Fallon could have put that vote to take place in the primary, which she did, or in the runoff, or in the general election. And depending on which one she called, manipulated what the turnout was going to be.
Yes.
And so one thing that could do is by putting in the primary, she tilted the Republican primary towards certain types of candidates. Or she didn't do it during the general, because in the general, that theoretically would have tilted it towards Democrats, so she wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
But if she was going to do completely fair, she should have put it at the runoff time, for the runoff, the time that you have the runoff election. Because, like I said, one taints the Republican primary, and I guess the Democrat primary to a lesser degree. The other one taints the general election. It would have been better to do the primary. That's why I said there should be, the runoff election. That would have been better to do it at that time.
Because there's not so much political...
That's right.
Political meat at stake.
That's it. So even when you time an election, there you go. I mean, she played politics within her own party. And then had she done it the other way, it would have been among parties. Does that make sense? The only one that would have been the fairest, that would have been fair within a party and between the parties, would have been the runoff election.
Because then it's just, that's not an open vote.
That's right.
You don't have people voting across party lines or
that's
everybody.
Right.
But yeah, so I get that. I mean, that's just... It's, you know, that this stuff goes on, but it's kind of, you know, when somebody kind of walks through it, it's just like, knew that was going on.
Which probably would be the ideal. The ideal, I would say, for, like I said, we're going back to when the voting would take place. School board elections would probably be good during primary days, because just in case there's a runoff, you've got that. Or you could do it during the runoff election, but then you wouldn't have a high turnout. Okay. But I would do it during that one. And then, but things like constitutional amendments, things of this nature, that I would probably schedule only one time and probably during the runoff dates, because that way you don't interfere with it doesn't throw the primary elections out of kilter, nor does it tilt one side or the other for the general election.
Now, do the states, each state has their own election commission that sets all of this, right?
Yes, yes.
So at each, because we have listeners from all over the United States here. Yeah. So, and so each state has like their own voting schedule.
Yes.
And that's set by the state election commission. So if you're not in Oklahoma and you want to know more about your state's voting days and when your state holds their elections, go on to the internet and then just go on to your state's election commission, and they should have all of that information there, because all of this information is public record. You just have to go and look for it.
Right. And some states will be a little more proactive than Oklahoma is. I mean, they're a little bit more fair when they schedule those elections. Some states may be worse. I don't know. I mean, but like I said, it would be hard to beat, what did I say? Yeah, eight dates, or excuse me, one, two, three, four, five, excuse me, six.
There might be a state out there worse than Oklahoma.
There might be a few. Listen on that, but I've seen shenanigans in other states. But anyway,
well, and it's not like there's not shenanigans on both sides.
That's right. Oh,
but,
yes.
But, yeah. You know, I mean, it's just, and I guess that's why people think politics is so dirty, because it is.
Well, I've
always
said, if you really want to find where the shenanigans are, instead of looking for a Democrat state or a Republican state, the bigger shenanigans are in one-party states. Doesn't matter which party it is.
And that is true, because, I mean, just look at Oklahoma. And, I mean, it's just like our pendulum in Oklahoma, it takes those really hard, like, the Republicans will be in, and then the Democrats will be in. And then the Republicans will be in, and then the Democrats will be in. There's no ever really, like, happy medium of, okay, we got a Democratic governor, and then our house is split evenly, or, you know, it's just – and that brings up – One of the other points I wanted to make is this, and I don't really necessarily know if I believe it, but this blue wave that's theoretically coming, do you feel like the Republicans have their work cut out for them in this general election? I mean, there's only like 60 days coming now, I mean, to the November 6th election at this airtime. So, I mean, what do you think the political landscape, you know, how do you think that that's, this election cycle, how do you think it's going to affect the political landscape come November 6th?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's – and usually I'll make pretty good predictions.
That's what I'm asking.
Well, you've seen me even predict – I think I've told you this, and my students know this. I've predicted even like the French elections 2 years out and got it right.
Beyond,
so I'm pretty good at these, you know, at different ones. But in my lifetime, I don't think I've ever felt more insecure about predicting what's going to happen, because again, you'll hear the blue wave, but I don't know. After the last election, I don't know, because both could be pretty fired up. It is hard to say. And you know, there's also this: weird things could happen in the next 50 days.
Very weird things.
All kinds. And again, I don't even mean just that the Republicans or the Democrats will do stuff. There's all kinds of weird stuff that could happen. Well, we have the hurricane. Not that that would be a big thing, but it could be. I mean,
oh, it's
we
huge.
Don't know. We don't know what's going to happen that's going to affect this.
Well, and I think the way that the states, and as an emergency manager, I mean, the way that the states handle that response in conjunction with FEMA, especially, I mean, just the news, even just the news. I mean, and it's not even my disaster. I'm not getting deployed or anything else like that. But even, and I know $10 million in the grand scheme is a drop in the bucket, but that's still concerning. That's still, you know, and then to have Puerto Rico declared an unsung success, it's like, that was a worse response than Katrina, and we had all the knowledge from Katrina. I mean, we built a whole communication system around what happened at Katrina. And so it's just really cause for alarm. And so those states that are on the coast who are going to get hammered by this, those people are absolutely going to be watching their legislators and how their
response
goes. That's
right. And again, this goes with the president, how this is going to affect his. Because on the one hand, you know, we mentioned, like you said, about the $10 million. That could be another thing. On the other hand, since he's this business guy who can kind of work around stuff, he may figure out how to get additional money. We don't know. I'm not saying he's going to do that, but you don't know. I mean, no one knows. That's what I'm saying, how this is going to play out. It could play out against him, or it could play out for him, depending on how he handles it. And again, it also plays out at the local level. What are those state governments going to do? So, and that will matter because the Carolinas are big.
Yes.
I mean, those pull a lot.
Yes.
It's a lot of PR.
It's a lot of PR.
Whenever this is one of those chances, one of those like make or break chances.
Yeah.
Where if they handle this the right way and respond the right way and everything gets taken care of, then it's one of those shining moments in your,
And we've seen this. You know, we think of the negative example being Katrina, but there are positive examples, like when Moore was hit. I mean, that was handled well almost every tornado season. But if you look at this, and usually I'm obviously not a Mary Fallon fan at all, never have been. But having said that, the one time where she peaked very high was after the Moore tornado. I mean, she had a very high approval rating.
Well, and
at that time.
And I think too, and especially here in Oklahoma, and I got to brag on us here in Oklahoma as far as emergency management goes, especially with tornadoes. We know what we're doing with tornadoes.
Well,
notice going back to this, I don't know if that was Mary Fallon's not fault, but if she was the reason for the success, or if it's just a fact she benefited from the success.
She benefited.
But either way,
what I'm saying is
it can play to your advantage too if it turns out well.
Well, but what I'm saying is we have been through this process so many times, and we had perfected the process of disaster declarations and requesting for that, and our governor's declaring a state of emergency and all that. So she already had the guidebook, and so once everything hit, everything just fires on all cylinders because it's already done, and you just submit your packet. So while, yeah, she did benefit from that, it kind of was, everything was already in place. She basically just had to sign the stuff and
that's right.
come out smelling like a rose.
And of course, like you said, and because we have to deal with so many disasters, we are better prepared than most. I remember the reverse of that. When I lived in Kentucky, If there was ever a giant ice storm, it would shut down the state, and people in Ohio would make fun of people in Kentucky. But the fact is, they don't get that many ice storms. People in Ohio get storms all the time, so they're prepared. So it's not cost-effective to be prepared in Kentucky as much. But like you said, here we're a little bit more prepared. But this one in the Carolinas is interesting because it's neither some place that never gets hit, nor is a place that gets hit much. So this really is going to... You know, what the federal response is will, you know, that could matter.
I think it's gonna matter in a big way. And one of my favorite races that I'm watching now is the Cruz O'Rourke race in Texas. I think Beto O'Rourke is going to unseat Ted Cruz.
And I don't know on that even. That's another, because again, when Cruz won the first time, that was not foreseen. So it's hard to read. You know, anytime we deal with reading Texas, we're playing a dangerous game. But anyway.
Crazy town.
Yeah, that's a different animal down there.
That's right.
Well, and so, let me ask you this, and it's like I said, you kind of stumped me a little bit because I thought you were going to have like all these wild predictions like you always do for the election. But do you feel like Trump going out and stumping for Republican candidates, do you think that's helping or hurting the Republicans as a whole?
I think where he chooses to stump probably helps him. I think he knows where it's going to help. I think where he doesn't choose to stump, he knows it may hurt him.
But the politicians that he has kind of chosen to stump for, some of them they're losing.
Well, those are primary ones, remember.
But still, that's within their own party. So that's kind of what they say a referendum on him is that his own party is kind of going against the people who he's
endorsing. Have to remember, money, this surprised you because he's a billionaire, but money goes against Trump in the Republican Party. He is not popular with the establishment.
Oh, no.
Of the Republican Party.
And that was clear in the election. That was clear in the general election.
Again, because, I'm not making a judgment. I'm just saying it's the establishment.
It just is what it is.
So a lot of that is, you know, even though we think of him being a billionaire, and he is, the money is not for him in the Republican Party. It's usually on the opposition and stuff. Again, he benefits from a popular wave. Not just in the Republican Party. You have to remember, 20%, it's estimated that 20% of Trump's voters in the general election were people that voted for Obama most likely twice. So it's, you know, figuring out the bass is a little different and stuff. It's not, and that's why I say it's hard to predict.
Yeah. I mean, college-educated women put Trump over the top, and that just like that.
But union, like I said, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who have in rural areas, but also in cities, who have not benefited from Republicans or Democrats in years, and I think their point was enough's enough. So again, that's why I can't predict on this, because. You know, the way most people make predictions is they look at, they base it off of, there's certain baseline elections that have taken place. Because you figure, you know, you go, when a person campaigns a lot of times, this is why I lose, I never did this, I just knock every door. But smart people, not me, but smart people will figure out, they'll get a list of, okay, let's see who's voted in the last four elections. That's whose doors you knock. Well, for Trump, he won because he got people that weren't voting for at least Republicans. And may have not voted even in a Republican primary. And so this is unusual. And so even if we look at how primaries went, that's not an indicator of what the general's going to do. Because you may have people that are going to turn out for Trump candidates who did not vote in the Republican primary because they're not Republicans.
Voting across party lines, that's and I do that,
which is okay. I mean, in the general, sure. So that's why I'm skeptical of trying to why I'm leery to predict what's going to happen.
It's going to be really interesting in that general because, I mean, everybody's like, well, Drew Edmondson, he's a shoe. I'm like, I just don't know. Well, I got into a
debate the other day, and I don't know that I'm right, okay? Uh-huh. But with a Republican voter, and we were talking about Drew Edmondson, and this person who's very smart and maybe smarter than me, I want to stress this on this, made the comment, of course, they don't want Edmondson to win, this person.
Right.
So they said, they feared that Little Dixie would turn out for Drew Edmondson because that's where he's from.
Yeah.
But then I made the comment that may be the problem for him in that where that's where he's from and that he has Muskogee. But the fact is now Little Dixie is the most rabid Republican part of the state. I mean, if you look, the most conservative part, you know, in the Republican primary, if you had to name all the Republican candidates, they all claim to be the most conservative. But let's face it, in the definition that we use for conservative nowadays, the most conservative candidate in the popular definition for conservative was certainly Dan Fisher. There's no doubt about that. That's just the way it is. I mean, you know, but and Dan Fisher did win the farthest southeast counties in the state. I mean, county in the state. And so that does not bode well for Edmondson. So again, but again, the other Republican was saying, yeah, but that's still his core. So I can't predict that. I mean, we can't even predict if Little Dixie is going to be a plus for him or a negative. And the same thing with this, with Stitt and Edmondson. You know, I don't know who's going to do well in Oklahoma City. I can't tell you.
And that's what I was going to say is, you know, usually we can predict that the Democrats will do better in the metro areas and the Republicans will usually take the rural areas.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't know
either, and I was kind of interested to hear what you had to say.
But I will say this.
I don't know.
I do want to mention one thing, though, that I think people are missing. This is something that will be kind of, I guess, a little out there, but it is an analysis I want to use, and that's this. There is this, a lot of people are saying, well, and this is neither anti-Stitt nor anti-Trump nor pro-Trump nor pro-Stitt. It's just a fact that I'm going to mention. There's this notion that, well, Kevin Stitt will be the Donald Trump of Oklahoma. And I think a lot of people will go in thinking that. But if you actually look at their backgrounds, they're almost complete opposites. And the reason I say that, the only thing they have in common is they're businessmen. But if you actually look at, and people I think are going in thinking he's like Trump. Now, whether you like Trump or dislike, I think it's a bad analogy. Because if you actually look at him, Donald Trump made his fortune through debt. He knew when to borrow. Kevin Stitt made his fortune by offering debt. They're actually come from opposite ends of the business world and different approaches. They are not the same person. The other thing is this. They'll say, well, you know, Stitt being an outsider is like Trump. And I know that's the popular mythology. You can call Donald Trump anything you want to in politics, but never call him an outsider. He's the most insider politician that I've ever seen in my life. And I'm not meaning this as an insult. I don't mean this negative, okay? I'm just saying this. But there's no one who was more of an insider than Donald Trump. Now, the reason I say that is this. Every other people say, well, the other politicians are insiders. Well, the other politicians are inside with the Democrats or inside with the Republicans. Donald Trump could play with both of them. And he knew how to play politics. And so Stitt and Trump are not the same person. One goes in as a true outsider. Now, whether that's good or bad, that's up to you. The other one went in with a lot of practical inside knowledge. So, that's where I'll run counter to it. Now, the myth will be, and I think most people when they go out and vote, if they like Trump, they're going to like Stitt. And if they don't like Trump, they're not going to like Stitt. What I'm saying, that's not, in reality, that should not be true. But people are going to vote that other way. So I may be right, but it's not going to pan out for me in the political prediction. Okay.
Listening to the inaugural view from the Crow's Nest. Thank you so much, Dr. Kevin Crow from the University of Science and Arts of Oklahoma. Thomas Ware III, I'm Kelly Lewis, and we will catch you back here next Saturday for the View from the Crow's Nest. Thank you so much. Have a great day.